You're listening to Avison on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights in government-driven markets. Today we are joined by August Cole, Avison's writer-in-residence, and Managing Director Jim Tinsley. August will be interviewing Jim about what we can expect to see at the upcoming AUSA conference in Washington, D.C.
So Jim, what do you expect will be the big takeaways from AUSA versus what you saw last year?
I think we'll see a sense of accomplishment from the Army combined with a greater sense of excitement from contractors. The Army has very much struggled in recent years, actually, I guess, going back a long way, to acquire next generation systems through the traditional procurement processes. FCS, GCV, any number of other programs we can name have been canceled after a long series of delays and bad starts. But we have a string of successes in programs like JLTV, JAGM, AMPV, and the Stryker Upgunning Program that promise better things to come. So we'll have a sense that we're exiting the platform market trough. We're past the trough that preceded JLTV and AMPV and the rest, and we actually see positive market growth in that area. And we have some new requirements like future vertical lift and mobile protected firepower, which are promising some new procurement activities, which is great. And beyond the platform side of the house, from what we've observed from enemy electromagnetic maneuver warfare, whatever you want to call it, we see more excitement and attention there in terms of what contractors can offer and what might be procured. This could really broaden the large system integrator interest in the Army and open the door to commercial and non-traditional players that had really exited the market as it declined. So while we don't expect to see the level of industry excitement from the 2008-2009 timeframe of the huge buildup, expect definitely a different attitude from the depression of 2012 and 2013.
How will what's going on in the world, so to speak, affect what you'll see at the show, given that there's more attention right now on Northern Europe territorial security among NATO members, particularly regarding Russia? Obviously, that has implications for the Army and industry. So what do you expect to see about that?
Well, there's a joke amongst industry folks that green is the new tan, where if you went to AUSA a few years ago, everything was painted tan, no camo, no olive drab. And so we're going back into the European theater where more traditional combat capabilities reside. And there's a recognition within DoD and industry that skill sets and equipment types have fallen behind investment capability curves with regard to Russia specifically, based on recent allied combat experience. So combat vehicles were a generation behind advanced protection systems, electronic warfare, anti-aircraft and counter UAS systems, even things like close combat capabilities for soldiers, which have been focused on counterinsurgency instead of more European-style battles, and certainly long-range fires as well, artillery and missile systems. So we're seeing a resurgence in investment and interest in some of these areas, long-range precision fires to replace ATACMs, some gunfire munitions programs, more interest in EW, which we'll talk about in a bit. But while either the Big 8 or Big 6 plus 1 that TRADOC has talked about promise something, they promise a lot less than the Big 5 recapitalization of the 80s with Apache, MLRS, Bradley, and Abrams, among others. But still some significant advances in capability are on the horizon. But we see three challenges that the Army faces that will impact industry. The first is we have 8, 6, 7 priorities. And so which of these is going to get funded within a constrained top-line environment? The Army is going to ask industry to invest more of its own dollars in advanced capabilities, as it has with JLTV and Future Vertical Lift. There has to be a payoff program at the end, and industry is going to want to see those results before they make significant investments. Second, if we're going to pre-position and deploy more units in Europe after withdrawing them to bolster allied confidence and deterrence, that's not free. So is the O&M required for those deployments going to be paid out of the base budget or from OCO accounts? And that could also impact that top line investment budget for both the Army and industry for the major recapitalizations. And the third question is whether those deployments will come with more selective acquisition of capability for in-theater equipment, similar to what was done in Iraq and Afghanistan. An example of that would be the Stryker Upgun program. Or is the Army going to move to more fleet enhancements and recapitalization that are more expensive overall, but really better in terms of commonality and amortization of investment costs? So is there going to be a new Bradley variant that emerges that's more adaptable to conventional warfare than the current version that was more adapted to Iraq. The incumbents are really going to benefit most from the large fleet recapitalizations and new variants. But if you are able to do this more selective acquisition approach, you could foster rapid innovation from traditional and non-traditional suppliers. So the Army probably needs a bit of a balanced portfolio here in terms of investment to encourage investment from contractors in one level to buy capabilities in a rapid fashion, but also to have the promise of a larger fleet recapitalization that will keep everyone interested in the market in the long term.
Where does the third offset and the autonomy conversation fit into the Army's future requirements? And the industry implications too for autonomy in supplying land forces also seems like they could be pretty profound.
They could be profound, and I think that's been one of the barriers. So the Army and Marine Corps have been experimenting with autonomy and machine learning and third offset technologies and leading development in certain areas like hypersonic weapons. But they do not own the missions that are most ripe for disruption and have been cautious about having too much risk in their portfolio after the failures of something like FCS. So FCS was a commitment to a larger network-enabled autonomy vision that was larger than any of the other services at the time. You know, platforms such as the Mule and the autonomous reconnaissance vehicle, UAVs, even the non-line of sight missile system, which would be rockets in a box left in different places in the battlefield and accessed through different networks in an unmanned fashion rather than being mounted on vehicles. But since that cancellation of that, the bold steps organizationally and doctrinally required to benefit from autonomy keep getting pushed off into the future. And so while autonomy is highly beneficial to survivability, efficiency, and cost effectiveness, we don't see that happening in the big steps that we had thought we would see by now. There are smaller steps that the Army could implement, safety enhancements, pilot assistance and augmentation, which they're talking about for future vertical lift, more capable and network swarming UASs and autonomous protection systems, that would provide a credible roadmap to more fully autonomous systems and essentially smaller steps. But it's going to be expensive, and whether they're ready to substitute for the soldier or not, which is the biggest question for fully autonomous systems, is not known at this time. Industry is ready for the change. The new tactical vehicles that are being procured, like JLTV, have C4ISR backbones and hooks for autonomous systems that could ease implementation far beyond our old trucks from the 1980s or the land systems that we had even in the 1990s. But the customer has to move beyond demonstration and start working on doctrine that then leads to funding.
Do you expect to see industry showing integrated cyber and kinetic concepts at AUSA?
Absolutely, and in many different forms. We've already seen displays of the converged technology, cyber and kinetic for counter UASs, when we're thinking about shows such as DSEI, Eurosatori, and IDEX, whether it's lasers, whether it's jamming, whether it's cyber combined with other tools. So we absolutely will see some of those systems on display at AUSA. The Army Multifunction EW program, or MFU program, is trying to leap ahead of the demonstrated Russian capabilities by converging detection, jamming, and cyber effects into one aperture, which is a very good aspiration. The issue has been that they have not moved forward into more of the program of record environment. We're still in the research and development S&T phase of that. And so if they could start to shape what MFU will look like, that would be very positive for industry in showing these integrated concepts. And finally, there's a management of the cyber kinetic solution space, what we call either electronic battle space awareness and C2. If you're going to have selectable effects, it works best when you understand all the tools in the toolbox and whether you're hammering a nail or sanding a block of wood, based on the toolkit that you have. And this is an area we'll definitely see displays and demonstrations, whether at the strategic level with something like Northrop Grumman's IBCS, which is the new battle management suite for Patriot, which has been selected by Poland as well, or at the more tactical level. BAE is going to show a handheld RF situational awareness sensor that they've worked on with DARPA that will help special operators and others understand where the emitters are and what tools they might have to take out those sensors or to spoof those sensors or have manage their detection ranges, that sort of thing. So we really should be able to see a lot of different demonstrations at AUSA.
Given the timing with the election in November, do you think that will play a factor at the show?
It's certainly going to be a topic of conversation around the hall, and of course, people are working different scenarios. But the issue is that neither candidate has really made significant policy assertions around the Army to counter or build upon, apart from very specific slices of the budget, such as missile defense, which would affect something like Patriot or IBCS. The political and budgetary future of the third offset in either administration is definitely going to be a question. Whether it was something that, Frank Kendall's dream of something that would invest in next generation technologies to avoid investing in current generation technologies. The role, size, and capabilities of U.S. forces in Europe, as we talked about earlier, there are different competing visions within the Clinton and Trump campaigns about that. The role of more commercial players, as encouraged by the DIACs, is that going to continue or is that going to be expanded? And then the commitment to next generation capabilities like future vertical lift and when those are actually going to happen are certainly all going to be discussed. And we don't expect any contractor to take a specific line at this point and make any bets. The issue is that companies are going to focus mostly at this show on protecting their interests rather than disrupting it or disrupting their competitors or disrupting the market, especially in the Army. Disruption works best when you can get something else to replace that capability. If you're saying we're in a position where there's a strong incumbent and we need to create a new capability that puts them out of that position, that's great. But we're in a position now where you won't actually be able to implement that change. You can maybe get something canceled, but you can't get something to replace it. So it doesn't seem to be a market right now that's ripe for disruption, at least until far after the election, maybe 1 or 2 years later.
Great, Jim. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Avasant on the Record. To learn more about Avasant, go to avasant.com or follow us on Twitter at Avasant.